Mobilizing hate is a fascinating and extraordinary duty into a journey into the banality of evil at the heart of Nazism. In 1942, it was an article of faith of what the Nazis called the Jewish question, and it had only one answer, the mass extermination of an entire people. 6 million European Jews were savagely murdered as a result of this perverted but profoundly held conviction. In this new book, Mobilizing Hate, Martin Davison looks at the twisted ideology behind the final solution. Joining me live on the line is Martin himself. Martin, good morning to you.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah,
jolly, jolly. It has been one of those mornings, Martin. Looking at, it seems hard to believe. It seems mind-boggling even now, some 80 years after we were in the midst of this, the worst crime against humanity. But one of the things that strikes historians and strikes people who look into this situation is how the lead up to the horror that became the Holocaust.
Yeah, it's there's a very definite, deliberate reason why I called the book Mobilizing Hatred rather than just hatred or anti-Semitism or racism. It's the idea that this was a deliberate construct. This was something that was the these embers, you know, they were breathed on to turn the embers into sparks, sparks into a fire, fire into an inferno. It was a deliberate and consciously constructed a project right from the start in all sorts of ways. So it's the idea, what I tried to do in this book is go back to first principles and to try to locate, if you like, what the mindset was. What was it in the people for whom this was such a motivating and energizing thing to think about? What was it about this that appeared to make such terrible sense to them? Because it wasn't just done as gratuitous sadism. It wasn't just savage cruelty or pitiless pitilessness. There was, unfortunately and tragically, a sense of rationale behind it, which is what makes the whole thing so horrifying. And that's what I try to do in the book, is locate that mindset, that view of the world which gave birth to it, and to follow the 20 years it took to nursemaid that set of ideas, if you like, into what became a policy. And then, thanks to the war, and then especially when the war became a world war, a genocidal policy in and of itself.
But obviously it wasn't something that was imposed on the people before that, because there is a history that dates back thousands of years. And in Europe, if you look at European history and the pogroms that took place, and even during the Crusades as they were heading towards Jerusalem or trying to get to the Levant, there are documented cases of good crusaders, good Christians taking out their wrath on Jewish communities as they passed through. So this didn't come out of the ether unexpected. It was, if you like, ingrained in the DNA of certain people and certain races for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
It has roots that are over 2,000 years old. And Germany is by no means the only country in which these views took root. I mean, the word Holocaust itself derives from the 13th century and was first used in Britain as a way of describing a policy when Edward I, the king, expelled the Jews very, very brutally from England. So this is, you know, you might actually have argued if you'd gone back to the early 20th century and said which country is more likely than any other to find a home for these kind of views, you wouldn't have chosen Germany with its liberal and assimilated Jewish population. France, Russia, there were countries where anti-Semitic feeling was far more latent than in Germany. But I think the thing I would say is that what happened in Germany, particularly in the years after the First World War, were unique. And it took hold of what up to that point had been a sort of religious, a sort of psychological, a kind of social way of thinking that had pinpointed in individual Jews and also Jewish communities, and also the idea of Jewishness, certain very, very negative attributes, which were the triggers for both suspicion and hostility and immense cultural distrust, often murderously expressed or violently expressed. But what happened in the years after World War One was that there was a step change, not just in kind, but in degree, to what these feelings, what they meant, the meaning that they were given. And that is what was so terrifying about it. And my book argues is that what you get in Germany, specifically in Germany, in the years, particularly after the First World War, is that for a small minority of hardline nationalists, of which Hitler is the most obvious example, what you get with them is a question, and a question that they rack themselves trying to answer, which is not just why did Germany lose the war? And remember, it's a world war, not just an ordinary war. Why did Germany, and how are they going to ensure? This is the really important bit. How will they ensure? How will Germany ensure that this never, ever happens again? How will Germany make itself safe for all time from having this kind of national catastrophe? And one of the answers that they look for is there's clearly something to be explained about what the German predicament was that allowed this defeat, this unforeseen, unmitigated disaster, this catastrophe to have happened. And the answer they settle on goes way beyond military questions. Normally, at the end of a war, the losing side will pick itself up by its bootstraps and go, right, we need to reform the army. Our strategies are all out of date. Our generals are no good. If we want to avoid defeat in the future, we have to sort out our armies, our navies, our air forces. But what Germany did, particularly in the mind of one Adolf Hitler and a small group of people like him, was go, no, the explanation goes much deeper than that. In order to make Germany safe from this ever happening again, we have to understand how power works in the world and what Germany was a victim of in the war. And it was not just a victim in their minds of a military defeat, but of something far more profound than that. And the role that this chimera, this delusion played was immense, which was that the figure of the Jew arose to the top as being a kind of central explanation, the only explanation that would satisfy them for what it was that had happened to Germany. And that delusion, what I call the biggest non sequitur in history, takes root in the mind of a small number. It is, and I have to stress this, it's a small number of people initially, and it becomes hardened, baked into them as an article of faith. And just lastly, the way I would describe that is that what Hitler realizes is that there are three ways of defining that what he would call the Jewish threat, and he adds a new one. So the two that the world has been most familiar with. So for thousands of years, there has been a terrible demonizing of this figure, this caricature figure of the Jew, and it's always the. That the moment somebody says and it's given a sort of pseudo-scientific gloss in the 19th century, and you have all this revolting language to do with bacteria and viruses, as though here is a people who are a social contagion. The second word is Judaism. And for 2,000 years, the Jews have had to face the charge that what started off, you know, they were the ultimate Christ killers and have stood opposed to Western civilization ever since. But the third, and this is the most important one, gets added to the mix. To those two very familiar, gets added a new caricature, which is the idea of world Jewry, international Jewry, which is this idea that there is a political matrix operating the strings of power around the world, and that what the 20th century is about to be the victim of is a bid for global power of a sort the world has never seen before. And that is what Hitler decides Germany must fight.
And we find that with people who cannot comprehend why something has happened, and they can't rationalize it, and so therefore there must be something else. I call it the fear of the other, and you cannot comprehend why something has happened in the natural order of things, so therefore there must be forces at work. And if you look [S2] Yes. [S1] if you look at the run up to and we forget the chaos that happened after the First World War, and the reason I say that is because 1870 the Franco-Prussian War. You know, the Prussians sweep through and absolutely obliterate the French, you know, with modern mechanized war, with modern warfare. I mean, people know about the Blitzkrieg that comes, and they talk about, you know, the invasion of the Low Countries. But the way that the Prussians go through and take over France with, you know, with modern warfare hasn't been seen before, and leads to the downfall of Napoleon III. Okay, but also you look at the fact that when you go into the First World War, there are three royal households. There is the Russian royal household, there is the German royal household, and there is the British royal household. And by 1918, only one of those royal households is still standing. And so that creates a vacuum of chaos. People can't explain it, and the natural order of things, because the Kaiser was pretty much, you know, pretty much on a pecking order close to God at the start of the war. He was this invincible father of Germany, and yet that has been blown out of the water, and by 1917 he is a forlorn figure playing war games in Berlin, whilst his generals, for example, through their actions by sinking shipping, bring America into the war and unleash all sorts of catastrophe upon the German people. And so therefore the ordinary German is now in a sea. Everything has been taken away from him. He can't understand why the German army has been beaten. And so there must be something at work. And that is what plays onto these dark yeah. tropes that have been sitting in the German psyche or the European psyche for generations.
Yes. And the reason, one of the reasons why a German nationalist, a thwarted, resentful German nationalist in the months after the First World War has so much to have explained, is because there have been, what I tried to describe in the book, is that there have been not just one disaster, but four global cataclysms have unfolded one after the other, all four of which have particularly, in the German mind, victimized Germany, and all of them, when you join them all together, provide four huge dots begging to be connected and begging to be seen as the expression of a conspiracy, not just a sequence of random events. The first is the Russian Revolution and the birth of Bolshevism. Well, Germany is, in the months after the First World War, Bolshevism was supposed to stay inside Russia, but it starts landing in Germany in a way that was never intended. And an entire German working class, through the mutinies, which are some of the reasons why the First World War collapses, is because there are naval mutinies in Kiel. There are what they call the Spartacists, who are essentially Bolshevik communist uprisings in the great cities of Germany. And the German working class looks ripe to be colonized by this alien idea that was only born in 1917. It's a new idea. The second is the way the war itself ends. And famously, as we all know, there was never a shot fired on German soil. The Germans appeared to give up in a way that took the German population entirely by surprise. Very different from 1945. Nobody looking at Germany in 1945 could be under any illusion this country is completely on its knees and has been defeated in the most total way imaginable. Not so in 1918. So the defeat seems bizarre. It seems a bolt out of the blue, and it seems contrived. The third thing is the Weimar Republic. So that you talked about the Kaiser, the royal families, all of which are great imperial powers or aspirational European powers. And suddenly Germany is a left-leaning democracy. It's never had it before. What's that about? And who have taken the reins of power? And then the last thing, of course, is the Treaty of Versailles, the famous bugbear of German nationalism, which is the moment when for a lot of German nationalists, the scales drop from their eyes and they realize we thought the First World War had ended in some kind of sort of unfortunate draw. And now Germany realizes that the rest of the world is ganging up on it and turning it into a pariah. And all four of those explanations become tangled up in the German fanatical German nationalist mind. Is they all have Jewish fingerprints on them. The link between Bolshevism and Judaism is made very early. The fact that it becomes very easy to start blaming social democrats, pacifists, and Jews. It's this catch-all word that gets used to explain anything considered unfortunate. The Weimar Republic. It's really easy to start pointing. Oh, it's the liberalism, which is a Jewish way of doing politics, and Versailles, final proof that the great powers, France, Britain, America, are in thrall to a desire to punish and do Germany down that is motivated by something beyond simple military revenge. Those are the things that gel in the mind of a small minority of Germans, and that is the seed from which everything that will follow will grow.
And also we have that struggle in Germany between, you know, you said, as you said, the Weimar is a left-leaning republic. Germany has never had anything like this. Most of Europe has never had anything like this. It's almost practically feudal in some of its dealings. And there is this huge, you know, violent struggle, you know, the street battles where people are being, you know, people are being murdered in the streets from both the left and the right. So it is a period of not, you know, we're talking ideology, but ideology in its most hateful sense as these street battles break out.
Well, the two things happen, which I think are absolutely fundamental to understanding this. First of all, you have to understand what's bizarre about all of this is that the Jewish question, as understood by the Germans after the war, played no part in the First World War. Not even the Germans think this is a war. There are 100,000 German Jews put on German uniform. Adolf Hitler gets recommended for an Iron Cross by his Jewish superior officer. So you have to ask, what happens in 1918 for this suddenly to become the way in which a small number of fanatical German nationalists start to define and justify what it is that's happened to Germany? And I think two things happen. And I'm afraid I do think that the figure of Adolf Hitler, I know it's become unfashionable in history to pinpoint individual leaders as being the great sort of pivots of history. We prefer to look at much wider social forces. But in this case, there is no question that you have to point the finger at a man. And two things happened to this man in the years between 1919 and 1923. The first is, this question about how to explain the world bursts into his head with the power of cosmic revelation, which is the way he describes it. He now realizes he can see, to his own satisfaction at least, the hidden nexus that the world is now at the mercy of, and he calls this Jewry. It is the power of the Jews in his mind. And the second thing that happens is, hot on the heels of this man having this moment of cosmic revelation, is he then discovers that this man who has had no tangible effect or impact or impression on anyone he's ever met is a complete non-entity, up to the point where the moment he starts expressing his views and his grasp of truth, it turns out he is this volcanic, extraordinarily charismatic presence who can produce rhetoric that like arcs of electricity, and suddenly the world is listening to him. Well, the world of his fellow nationalists in particularly in Munich, and before he can fully understand what has happened to him, he has the power not only of understanding truth as prophecy but of expressing it as that, and the two things will come together and they will fuse in his mind, which I think is an explanation why from this point on to the moment he puts a bullet through his own head in 1945, the centrality of the Jewish question remains completely unchallengeable.
And also, the living standards of ordinary Germans in the Weimar Republic drop through the floor because of the devaluation of the currency, massive inflation. And again, we go back to that old trope about, well, it's the Jew. He is claiming the financial. He is manipulating the financial markets. And the reason, you know, if you're sitting there in Munich and you suddenly can't buy a loaf of bread, you have to find a reason for it. And that is the reason.
There are two aspects to the modern world that the world of, you talked about 1870 and the Franco-Prussian War and the era of Bismarck and the great statesmen of Europe who between them govern European affairs and the balance of power and all the rest of it. The two things that they didn't have to deal with to anything like the degree that became a central obsession in the years after the First World War, the birth of the modern world, when the modern world really emerged in all its contours, were the power of international finance and the power of ideology. These are new things. And both of them, one associated with the left and the other with the right, become very quickly identified in a paranoid conspiracy theorist mind with the Jews. They are both the architects of communism and Bolshevism, and they are the architects of this phenomenon of Wall Street and the international stock market that is now playing a role or aims to play a role in the world affairs. Obviously the stock market has existed for a long time, but it is deemed to have a power and what happens in Germany is with hyperinflation and with American loans that have to be repaid, particularly after the Wall Street crash in 1929, is Germany is racked by the processes of international finance. I mean, national debt and now, that's existed since the Middle Ages, but never to this degree. And as in the Middle Ages, when it was associated with Jewish moneylenders, it's a very easy jump to make and to start making that accusation. So the type of paranoia that what Hitler is expressing is now stopped being personal. It's become these are the impersonal forces that shape the modern world. Germany is a unique victim of them both. And hidden behind them are agents. There's an agency at work, and he has a way of describing who those people are.
And added to that is the new technology of mass communication and propaganda. And nobody could manipulate the propaganda such as the team. And it seems funny to talk about a PR team, but it is true, because, you know, Hitler very quickly and very soon brings on acolytes such as Goebbels, and if you listen to the speeches, there is no denying that Hitler was able to speak passionately and get a message across. And with the movie cinemas and the radio and the control that Goebbels soon has over the media and mass propaganda, he sells this twisted message to a people who have had enough of the status quo and are looking for something, and this is it's being pointed out to them, and the quote unquote fake news that they are putting together seems to draw the dots and lead it to its horrendous conclusion.
It's absolutely right that type of propaganda, and Goebbels is definitely the malign genius behind it, because he understands the mass media better even than Hitler. And what you realize is that when the Germans come to power, when the Nazis come to power in 1933, 6 million people have voted for the Nazis who never have ever before. And they're not anti-Semites. They're not doing this in order to humiliate their Jewish neighbors. They're doing it because of the promise of a revitalized economy, a commitment to jobs. You know, their lives are miserable. And what Goebbels is so good at doing is realizing that there is this huge gap between what he would call the fanatics, the inner core, for whom there is no measure too cruel to be applied to Germany's Jews, and the agnostic majority, for whom this is just not a priority. And most of them have never even met a Jewish person. So what he very skillfully does is it's very interesting to see, he turns the dial up and down. So it's not just blood-curdling rhetoric from day one. He knows when they've overplayed their hand and pulls back. And what I tried to describe in the book is that what Goebbels realizes is that in order to turn Germany's population, it's 1% of the population are Jewish, and that the two most powerful links that bind a minority to the wider community are sex and money. In other words, who are you married to and how you earn your living? And he targets them both. So the first thing he does within weeks of Hitler coming to power is the economic boycott. And we've all seen the images. There's not a history documentary ever made that doesn't have those shots of the Nazi stormtroopers standing in front of German department stores, daubing the Jewish symbol on the windows, telling Germans not to shop there. Doesn't work, interestingly, because an awful lot of Germans are going, well, I've been buying from this shop for 20 years and they're good. Or you're a German farmer who's been buying their cattle feed for two generations from a particular Jewish merchant. So Goebbels backs off. He realizes, okay, we need to reformulate how we do this. That didn't quite work as well as I thought. And the other way of doing it, of course, was sex. And at that point, nothing to do with Goebbels, but the other type of German propaganda, Nazi propaganda, came in. And there was a man called Julius Streicher who edited this hate rag called Der Stürmer, which was absolutely heaving with the most pornographic and disgusting mixture of sort of religious scatology and endless stories of sexually predating Jewish men preying on virtuous German womanhood. And that although Der Stürmer was considered very unrespectable by middle class Germans, nevertheless that started to kind of get a grip on the national imagination, and it triggered what these things were called pillory marches. So you see photographs of them all over, particularly in the provinces. Couples would be targeted where the race line between German and Jewish, because they're both German. I mean, you know what I mean? German and German Jewish had been crossed, and the couple would be frog marched with placards around their neck up and down the town, being spat at and booed and jeered before being taken off by the police and beaten up, if not worse. So it started off as sex and money, and then gradually became more and more respectable as what Goebbels turned to with all the academics and the intellectuals and the anthropologists and the sociologists and even the theologians were all mobilized to provide their tuppence worth for what it was to make the idea of being really suspicious of Jewish life as respectable as possible. And you put all the things together and it became like a maelstrom.
And he draws on that sort of false Teutonic Knight, that Norse mythology. And that's we can have a conversation about that, which will last until about Friday. But he substitutes this image of virtuous, of, you know, of the well, we have the Untermenschen, you know, and then we have the, you know, the Uber, which is this perfect Germanic, Teutonic, Aryan species, which doesn't exist. But by crafting Nordic mythology and the sort of art and music that he likes or they like, they put forth this propagandist idea, and everything else is degenerate.
It's exactly right. It is us and them, and nobody understands the power of a polarized country of people on the inside of the circle of humanity and those who have been condemned to live outside the circle as much as the Nazis did. And for them, they derived a huge amount of political power from this, because unlike the Soviet Union, which is a system based on the idea of class, what you get in Nazi Germany is a system based on the idea of biology and race. I mean, much perverted, but that's the language in which they use. And what you find is, but I think you find it in the rhetoric. And this is the other thing I tried to bring out in the book to, if you like, and I do this with a light touch, is to point out possible contemporary echoes, and it's to do with an emotion. And what you find with Hitler's rhetoric and with Goebbels's rhetoric, two things happen at once, and one is anger and resentment and disgust for a minority group who are blamed for trying to get away with something, trying to do you down, and they've been caught out. And to use the phrase that Hitler, the joke that Hitler kept using in his speeches was, they're not laughing now. Mm. And there's a sort of, and I use this word, malevolence. There's a kind of sort of sadistic glee in that. Yeah. Wipe the smile off. You thought you'd pulled one over on decent German people, folk. And we saw through you. And not only do we see through you, but we've cast you down. So the two feelings, the one of sort of hatred and resentment and fear, is always coupled to self-exaltation, to self-righteousness, and to bigging yourself up. So you push down and you elevate up, the two, and they both have the effect of making that sense of polarization between an in-group and out-group even more exaggerated.
And when people will say, oh, well, I would have done something about this. I couldn't have let this sort of thing pass. You know, it's always a great trope. I would have stood up for myself and wouldn't have been sucked in by this. But you make some very interesting points. And it's interesting because your grandfather was a member of the SA, of course, who were the brown shirts, this should have been a warning to people who were wiped out in the beginning of the 30s because of the internal power struggle. But if you look at, there's four levels of how Germans react to this new twist of philosophy, all the way from what you call malevolence, which is basically evil, through to sort of indifference, because we have these autobahns being built, we have public works, Speer is putting together these wonderful public, so I have food on my table, my son has work, you know, my husband has a job, and so I don't really care who's in charge, because it doesn't affect us anyway, this is the way they're thinking, for the ordinary Germans, they go about it, and it makes them, there is a feel-good factor to this.
Yes, I think there really is something in that, because you, when you try and understand, well, what motivates a whole population to you know, how and again, it comes back to my word mobilizing. How do you mobilize a population? Because what I've tried to track in this book is it starts off as an idea. It becomes a guiding principle for a political movement, a minority one, a splinter group. And then after 1933, it becomes the guiding principle for a regime. All of this takes work, and it takes a lot of finessing, and it takes a lot of masterminding. It is not latent. It's not just there. It's not just a volcano where you pierce the lava surface and the fire, the flames just burst out. It isn't like that. It takes a lot of work. But what Goebbels realizes, his genius insight, is that you don't need everyone to be a fire-breathing, Nazi hard core anti-Semite genocidal psychopath. Clearly there is an inner core where there are a lot of those. But what he realizes is it's like concentric rings. Outside them, you need the next ring out to be, and I borrowed these words from, there's a book I read, which was a biography, a sort of a study about the role played by the SS, the architect of the Holocaust, Adolf Eichmann, who, you know, famously put on trial in 1961 and hanged by the Israelis. In this book, he ends up saying, you know, I've spent my life, he was a director of Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Institute in Jerusalem. I spent my life studying these people, and I've come to the conclusion there are four levels of evil. And I remember reading it thinking, you can't reduce all, that sounds a bit trite. What, four levels? That doesn't make sense. But actually, it's really stuck with me. And the bottom level is indifference. But indifference is not ignorance. It's, well, no smoke without fire. I mean, I don't have any personal animosity. But on the other hand, if people who know a lot more about these things than me claim they do, well, it's not in me to stand in their way, and I'll get on with my life. The next level up is selfishness, where you go, well, you know what? I'm not prepared to do anything about it. But now you mention it, I do think there's a case here to be answered for. And the third level is heartlessness, where you go, well, it's not in my power to do anything about it, but I really, really, now this stuff has really spoken to me, and I've had my eyes open to the truth of it, and I'm glad somebody is doing something about it. And the fourth level, the top level, is malevolence. And the thing that's interesting about the word malevolence is it means doing evil, wanting to do it, benefiting from it. It's not the same thing as, quite a lot of people get into trouble when you start trying to define it, when people say what caused all this, and they say, oh, it was evil, and you think, well, what does that mean? It's an abstract quality. And malevolence, the key to malevolence is making people suffer, and making people suffer while at the same moment exalting yourself, I think, is a very, very familiar political, I think something we're all prey to. That moment when you see, I don't know, I was thinking about when Suella Braverman is talking about her dream is to see these migrants put in a plane and sent to Rwanda. Well, if you break that down, she's not articulating a policy. And whatever you think about the immigration question, there are questions. It does need to have a policy. She said it's her dream. In other words, it's something to be fired up by. And the whole point about Rwanda in that sentence is it's implicit that they're not going to like it there. There's going to be some suffering. And the other implicit part of that sentence is, these migrants thought they got away with it. They were laughing at us. They were taking the piss in their 4-star hotels. Well, I put an end to it. And not only have I put an end to it, I'm going to make sure that the one thing that happens to them as they sit on that plane on the front of the Daily Telegraph that I'm exalting it is they will have the smile knocked off their faces. There won't be any more victory signs from them as we walk them across the beach in Britain. And as a tiny example, and I am not remotely suggesting that this is quasi Nazi behavior at all. I'm not at all. I'm just saying that it's there's a psychological spring at work, and it's one that we've seen everywhere. Every culture is susceptible to it. This is not just a German thing, but I think those three elements. There are people taking the piss. I've spotted it, and I'm going to make those people suffer, and we will all exult. We, who are not them, will exult in seeing it happen. And I thought there was something performative about that interview that just thought sparked something, and the smile on her face as she was saying it, and the kind of the sense of cheering from the people who wanted it and the sense of sort of horror from the people who didn't, just thought the temperature of politics had been raised. And I was worried by that.
Martin, I'm going to run out of time, and I've only just got going, as the saying goes. If people want to find out more information about you or about the book, Mobilizing Hate, where can they find you online and on the social medias?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Peter Davidson, and if you just Google if you Google the book Mobilizing Hate, that will come up. But my other book, where you talked about when I discovered my grandfather had been a Nazi, I wrote a book in 2010 called The Perfect Nazi, and if you Google that, it will come up, and they will come back to me. I did a podcast. There's a podcast called We Have Ways of Making You Talk.
Yes, indeed. I've interviewed Al Murray. The book is. So I know all about that and catch on that. The book is called, I'm going to run out of time, I'm so sorry. The book is called Mobilizing Hate, The Story of Hitler's Final Solution. Martin Davidson, thank you so much for your time today.